And welcome to TwerpCast, episode number 31, What You Talking About Willis Cast. Gary Coleman could not be here to join us today, so it's just Willis Cast, all things Bruce Willis. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Jim Caswell, executive producer of TwerpCast, social networking boycotter, and least likely to run around using a blonde bombshell surrogate.
And he is Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerp and former volunteer to work as Bruce Willis's stunt double. They turned him down, saying he looked too old.
Well, Jim, before we get into the highlights of Bruce Willis's career, why don't you tell us a little bit about the man, the myth, the legend?
Born Walter Bruce Willis on March 19th, 1955, he spent the first couple of years of his life in West Germany. His father was a U.S. soldier stationed there, and when he finished his tour of duty, he brought his entire family to America in 1957. Bruce was the eldest of four children. He joined the drama club in high school, but after graduation went on to work as a security officer, a bartender, and even a private investigator.
Sounds like the typical career of a budding actor.
He returned to school and joined the drama program at Montclair State University, but he dropped out his junior year and moved to New York, where he did some off-Broadway and commercials before moving to California.
I can honestly say I've done all of my acting off of Broadway.
Way off-Broadway.
After moving to California, he does some television. He's on the new Twilight Zone. He's on Miami Vice. And then he gets a little show. Not many people know about it. What was it called again, Jim?
Moonlighting.
Oh, yeah. What was that about?
Oh, it was just this little show. It was on for 5 years. Critically acclaimed. Highest ratings for the network for the first three of those years. You know, nothing big.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Oh, and not to mention the fact that it also set a whole new standard for romantic comedies and detective shows that's still followed to this day.
It was this romantic mystery comedy where there's the private investigator and her sidekick, not Remington Steele. That's the other show.
Yeah, that was on NBC, whereas this was on ABC.
But in all seriousness, one of the things that it really did for a while was hold that romantic comedy and the sexual tension between the actor and actress. After the fact, you know, hindsight being 20/20, I'm sure a lot of that tension was actual tension between the two of them.
Bruce Willis played David Addison, Sybil Shepherd played Maddie Hayes, and casting Sybil Shepherd at that point in time was actually considered a bit of a coup because she was a fairly well-known model. Had been in Taxi Driver and The Last Picture Show and The Heartbreak Kid, all fairly well-known movies at the time. So she was the big name for the show. And then they have Bruce Willis, who at the time was tending bar to help pay bills and things of that nature. So he was the unknown and she was the big name star. And he just took off like a rocket. Between his strong stage presence, his comedic timing, and let's be honest, his good looks, he instantly became a fan favorite.
Yeah, honestly, this is one of the shows that I grew up with. I think in hindsight, one of the things that really upset Sybil Shepherd was she was the star, but he was the fan favorite. To compare this to something that we know very much about, Star Trek, Spock was never intended to be the lead character, but Leonard Nimoy received by far the most fan mail.
And Moonlighting really had a heavy impact on the television community. Many, many times, they would break down the fourth wall, and they'd talk directly to the audience, or Maddie would say something, and David would look at the audience and roll his eyes, you know, bringing the audience into the show, making them an active part of it. And this stuff just hadn't been heard of before this point.
It's true. I mean, I think that they took the best of everything. When you look at Breaking the Fourth Wall, I think of things like the Carol Burnett Show and just watching Harvey Korman and Tim Conway just crack each other up. I mean, you could tell these people really enjoyed their work. Well, when you look at a show like Moonlighting, although it was not necessarily spontaneous, it still had that feeling of here's people who enjoy what they're doing and they want to share it with the audience.
On the downside, it's also the standard example of what happens when you take this couple who has this romantic tension and you give the audience what they want. You have the two of them sleep together. And when that romantic tension is now gone, the audience really lost interest. It's one of those rare examples of giving the audience exactly what they wanted and then having them turn around and bite you for it.
I think from the point of view of the writers, from the point of view of the producers, they've learned from their mistake. It was unfortunate for the show because, honestly, the release of that tension also released the audience to go watch something else. Another show that I watched today that's similar is Bones. You got David Boreanaz and Emily Deschanel, and they have a huge sexual tension. And the producers have said, you will not see them sleep together.
Because they don't want a repeat of the moonlighting phenomenon. But Bones is a great example of how they use this moonlighting formula even today. Both Bones and Castle are great examples of this.
Castle in its own way is kind of an imitation of Bones, but that doesn't mean it's not a good show.
So yes, if there's romantic tension between the two lead characters and the audience is screaming, hook them up, get them together, and the directors are saying, no, no, we aren't going to do that, it's because of the moonlighting effect. They saw what happened there and were never able to get it back again. So Bruce was very popular on moonlighting, and Hollywood saw that he was going to be a big draw. So Blake Edwards looked at him and said, hey, he's good at the romantic comedy stuff. I'm working on a romantic comedy. I'll cast him. He's a good choice for it. So Bruce Willis starred in Blind Date. It co-starred Kim Basinger and John Larroquette, who at the same time was also in a popular comedy series called Night Court. And the movie was okay.
The movie was a critical failure. If you're a fan of bad movies, which I am, I highly recommend it. I would never, ever tell you this is a good movie. It's never going to get an Academy Award. It's never going to get a Raspberry Award. This is not a good movie. I love it. It's one of my early DVD collection purchases. Unfortunately, it's not a good movie, and I can't watch it over and over again. But I still love it.
Bruce Willis plays this guy who gets set up on a blind date with this beautiful woman, only to find out that she's got a stalker ex-boyfriend who is trying to beat him to death because he's out on a date with the love of his life. And the way that I just stated that sounds nothing like a comedy. It sounds like an incredibly horrific tale, and if John Larroquette was played by Eddie Murphy, it would ring way too close to home for O.J. Simpson.
And there's kind of this twist on there that Kim Basinger is allergic to alcohol. She has a really, really strong allergic reaction to it. And she doesn't know that her cold medicine has alcohol in it. And she takes her cold medicine and all sorts of funniness ensues.
But it's not like her face breaks out. No, she just gets drunk really, really, really easy. A fact that I'm sure Alec Baldwin made good use of.
Okay, so the first movie he makes doesn't kill his stardom, but it doesn't shoot him to the A-list yet.
His follow-up movie, though, was released during the summer but set during the winter, about a police officer who travels across the United States to reunite with his estranged wife on Christmas Eve in the middle of a hostage situation. Did I mention that it was called Die Hard?
Die Hard did anything but that to Bruce Willis's career. There's three sequels out there. He's one of the top 10 movie grossing actors in the country. This was a good career move for Bruce Willis.
I remember seeing it, and it was phenomenal. The movie did have some comedy in it, because he was known for his comedy, but it really set him up well as being an action star as well. It put him up there in the ranks of a Sylvester Stallone, a Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was right up there with them as far as action heroes go.
More so than anything, this movie put him on the A-list. His performance ability and his choice of his future movies kept him on the A-list, but it put him on the A-list. Honestly, Bruce's career has had its ups and its downs.
Yeah, two good Die Hard films, one that was horrible, and one that was okay. Oh, you mean beyond Die Hard, okay.
Yeah, I don't even consider that third film Die Hard, I just consider it crap. But on the other side of that equation is one of the movies that I think he wants to forget he ever made, that Hollywood gives him crap for, that nobody likes this movie. So right after Die Hard 2, the very next year, he comes out with this movie, Hudson Hawk. He's got two incredible action movies under his belt, and admittedly, this movie has explosions and it's got gunfights in it. And so the studios prepared trailers and promotional material and posters picturing Hudson Hawk as the next action hero. A little problem with that.
It's a comedy.
Oh, this movie is so funny. I told you I like Blind Date because Blind Date's a bad movie. This is not a bad movie. It's a strange movie, absolutely. but it is so funny.
The problem with the movie is literally people went in to see Die Hard under a different name. They were expecting it to be all action, a little bit of comedy thrown in with little one-liners and quips, but they were not expecting a laugh fest.
This movie is literally making fun of action movies.
And it is hilarious. Admittedly, Doug and I are the only two people that I know of who love this movie. But we love it because we were able to look at it and see it for what it was and enjoy it as a comedy instead of getting our noses in a snit because we were expecting an action film.
I could do an entire Torpcast on just this film. I want to tell you about the funny scenes. I want to talk about this for 2 hours. To call this an action-adventure is just ridiculous. There's a scene towards the end of the movie where Danny Aiello is locked in a limo. The limo is on fire, it's got a bomb in it, and it goes over a cliff. And in the end of the movie, he comes running down the street and he meets Bruce Willis. And Bruce Willis is like, "I thought you were dead." And Danny Aiello's sole explanation for coming back is, "Airbags, can you believe it?" Okay, I edited that for content, but...
But the car was on fire!
Sprinklers! I mean, they did not take this movie serious at all. And you go back to the moonlighting, breaking the fourth wall, that's what this movie is. This was comedy. It was all about the timing. And it's got Richard Grant in it. It's got Sandra Bernhardt in it. It's got Andie MacDowell playing an undercover nun for the Vatican. And she thinks that she can speak dolphin. Got Richard Coburn in it. I mean, this has got a brilliant cast. On the one hand, I'm angry that it didn't do better. But on the other hand, I kind of feel like I have got this secret film that I know about and nobody else does.
And even the silly reoccurring gags, like him desperately wanting a cup of cappuccino. Through the entire movie, everything that he does is based on him trying to get this cup of cappuccino and it being ruined for him in some way, shape, or form. It's absolutely hilarious, and if you've never seen this film, go on out and rent it. If you have seen the film and you're sitting there going, "I don't remember any of this good stuff," go and watch it again, but keep in mind, it's a comedy.
Yes, it's not Die Hard Part 3, which was kind of laughable, but that's not what I mean. I mean, it's funny.
We cannot say enough good things about it. Another one of my favorites, of course, is Sixth Sense. We did an entire Torpcast dedicated to M. Night Shyamalan, and this was M. Night's first feature film, and it would not have been the movie that it was if it hadn't been for Bruce Willis.
Haley Joel Osment was spectacular in this movie.
Oh, very much so. You are correct on that one. The boy has acting chops, and the fact that he's all but disappeared is a real shame, because if he had that kind of talent at the age of 12, I can only imagine what he could do if he was actually handed a good role today.
That's a whole other Torpcast, but it is a shame what happened to him. You know, he could have gone the way of Hollywood actors of going into drugs and therapy and all that, and instead he just went into obscurity, and that's almost a crime.
It's funny because Bruce Willis's career in Hollywood kind of reminds me of Weird Al Yankovic's career in music. When Weird Al released his newest album 2 or 3 years ago, they called it a comeback because he hadn't done anything in 2 or 3 years. That's how he typically does things. He waits 2 or 3 years, he sees what's popular, and then he parodies it. Bruce Willis is the same way. Every couple of years, he has a quote-unquote comeback movie that puts him back on top, and then he'll do 3 or 4 other things that won't be as good. Then he'll do something else that's fantastic, and again, it becomes his comeback movie.
I want to just agree with your sentiment that Sixth Sense, he is terrific in, and it's that interplay. And this is what I really think you meant. It's the interplay between Haley Joel Osment and Bruce Willis. I think what you were trying to say when you were saying that Bruce Willis makes this film, that it's really the interaction between Haley Joel Osment and Bruce Willis, and the third off-screen character of M. Night Shyamalan. This movie was just the perfect storm. It was at the right time, it was the right people, it was the right story, and everything came together. It's hard discussing this and Hudson Hawk, because Hudson Hawk is so irreverent and so funny. They're completely 180 degrees different movies. I'm going to leave it at that. This movie was the perfect storm. We've already given M. Night his due on this. Another movie that's a perfect storm, another movie that was a comeback for Bruce Willis, actually a comeback for other actors as well, was Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, this is one of those movies that you and I have differing opinions on. I loved Pulp Fiction. it is still one of my favorite movies. And we've discussed about how Tarantino is gory and foul, and at times he really seems as though he's trying to go out of his way to offend people. And yet I still love the man's work. And Pulp Fiction, much like Sixth Sense was M. Night's feature debut, Pulp Fiction was Quentin Tarantino's first big name feature film. He'd done Reservoir Dogs before that, but that was more of an indie film, not as well known. But Pulp Fiction was his first big budget, full studio backing film.
Yes, I'm that one guy out there who wrote the bad review of Pulp Fiction. I do not like it. I think that every character in that movie is completely reprehensible. Despite the filmmaking, and I understand what Quentin Tarantino went through doing a non-linear movie and telling multiple stories, it was the fact that every single person in this movie is a bad guy. I couldn't get into it. There was nothing for me to root for.
Again, a perfect example of why I shouldn't love this movie. I hate movies where I don't have somebody to root for. And I completely agree that every single one of these characters were bad guys. They had very little redeeming value to them. And in spite of that fact, I was still able to root for them. And to me, that's a credit to Tarantino's storytelling ability, that he was able to take these characters that under any other circumstance I would have hated and made me like them, especially Bruce Willis's character. When Bruce Willis goes to town on the guys in the shop who are rapists, that just made the movie for me. And the fact that he was using a samurai sword in the process was just gravy.
Yeah, I really didn't need to see anal rape. That was going too far for me.
But it showed that as bad as these people were, there were worse people out there.
I will agree with that. That doesn't mean you want to watch it. I mean, sure, there are people less likable than Jeffrey Dahmer. I don't want to be Jeffrey Dahmer's friend.
The other cool thing about this movie, though, was the fact that Bruce Willis saw the potential of the film and said, sure, not only will I be in this, at the time, no-name director's movie, but I like it so much, I'm going to work for scale. He didn't demand the $10, $20 million salary that he was entitled to. He was a big name. Yes, it was his quote-unquote comeback, but it wasn't that big of a comeback. He did have the diehards under his belt. He did have a bunch of big-name blockbusters behind him. So he could have gone, you know what, I'm not doing this unless you give me at least $10 million. And he didn't. To me, that's one of the things that makes Bruce Willis a great person, not just a great actor, but just a great person in Hollywood.
I would agree with that, actually. Unlike some of the people who air their laundry in public, that he has always been calm under pressure, and his persona anyways, whether or not it's the real him, is a very generous person. I mean, you've got all these big-name divorces in Hollywood, and the people going back and forth. Does Jennifer Aniston hate Angelina Jolie? Does Nicole Kidman hate Tom Cruise? Well, all this type of crap is going on, and just keeping people in the limelight. You've got Bruce Willis and Demi Moore. Again, it may just be a part, but at least publicly, they're very good friends. They make a show of going, you know what, we loved each other once, we just don't now.
And being great parents together. Yes, their marriage had ended, but they both understood that we have kids, we have a responsibility to those kids, and we're not going to drag these kids into the middle of whatever may be going on between us. Those kids had two parents.
I think they're probably one of the classiest non-couples that Hollywood has seen in years.
Heck, Bruce Willis even became friends with Ashton Kutcher. I mean, this is the guy who moved in, took over the role as daddy, and started sleeping with his ex-wife. And he's 20 years younger than he is. If anybody had a right to get ticked off, it was Bruce. And he was really cool about it. He made friends, he made a guest appearance on the 70s show. Has been seen in public all the time, hanging out with Aston and Demi and being really cool about things. He's also very well known for making guest appearances and stuff. He doesn't have to be in the limelight. When Charlie's Angels 2 came out, he did a non-speaking guest role of the guy who gets assassinated by Demi Moore's character just because, hey, she's my friend, she's coming back into Hollywood. People get a kick out of this. So, sure, I'll do it. I just saw the other day the newest Nancy Drew movie, and he made a guest appearance in that, playing himself. And it just oozes the idea of him being a very likable guy, a very easygoing guy who just loves what he does and is willing to help people out. I remember back when Moonlighting was having its rough times, and you'd read in the tabloids about how he and Cybill Shepherd refused to be on set with one another, and there was this big fight going on between them and all this other stuff. And in spite of all the nastiness that supposedly went on set, Cybill Shepherd will still, to this day, say, "Yeah, I really like Bruce Willis. He's a great guy, and we're still friends."
Well, I think that says it all about Bruce, actually.
I'd love to be able to call him my friend. We would normally probably go through and list all of the movies that he's been involved in and go into some great detail, but if we went into detail on his entire movie career of 30-plus movies, this Torpcast would end up running into hours, and we just don't believe in doing that to
you. It's the first annual 30-hour Torpcast!
So, believe it, he's great. There are some stinkers out there, don't get us wrong.
But, Die Hard with a Vengeance!
But his batting average, as far as movies are concerned, is above 500.
Which brings us to the newest movie, Surrogates. I'll be honest, I think that Hollywood has done this movie a disservice. Before I saw the trailer for Surrogates, I had never heard of this movie. I didn't know Bruce Willis was going to be in another movie. This is one of the most under-advertised movies I've ever seen. But when I did see the trailer, I saw Bruce Willis in a sci-fi movie, I was like, I'm there.
We actually saw the trailer at the exact same time, and we just both looked at each other and went, oh yeah!
And before we get into the meat and bones of this, I do have something to say. It was directed by Jonathan Mostow, who also directed Terminator 3, which, in my humble opinion, is by far the worst of the Terminator movies.
It's not just your opinion.
I was really worried about this movie because it was directed by Jonathan Mostow. I have to say, Jonathan, you are forgiven.
Just don't ever touch the Terminator franchise again, please.
Yes, Jonathan, keep your hands off Arnold.
The movie was based on a 2005 five-issue limited series comic book produced by Top Shelf. I only learned that right before we started recording. Up until that point, I thought that there was some writer in Hollywood that actually finally listened and came up with an original idea.
That'll never happen.
Instead, he took an original idea from a comic book, which in Hollywood is about as close as they get to an original idea. So we'll still give him half credit.
I'll be honest, the press that I've seen on this now has been negative. And after watching it, I don't think it's going to make a lot of money. I don't think this is going to be one of those movies that Bruce Willis has remembered. Oh my God, you've got to see Surrogates.
I'm going to go on record right now as to saying, oh my God, you've got to see Surrogates.
I second that statement. This is actually a well-put-together classical science fiction movie. One of the headlines that I've read on this actually said, Best Film of the Year, 1981. And it was really meant as a dig. It's funny because it's so right and it's so wrong at the same time. This is a movie that tells the classical scientification story. It takes an idea. What if this happened? Let's watch it to its ultimate conclusion. And I think it was done really well. I mean, it has a lot of special effects in it, but it's not spaceships blowing up things. It's not zombies running all over the place. They're little tiny special effects, like making Bruce Willis look like he's 25 years younger. You don't really notice it because it looks so natural. Whether that was done by computer animation or whether that was done by prosthetic makeup or whatever, it's still a special effect, and it was done for the story. It wasn't like this big deal. Ha, look at this machine which can make you look 20 years younger.
Another key component of good science fiction, and this is the part that I loved the most about this film, is the fact that good science fiction is going to take a modern situation, a modern problem, a modern bigotry, something of that nature, and they're going to include it into the science fiction story as a morality play. This happens all the time in science fiction, and it really is an ingredient in good science fiction. Good science fiction is not how many spaceships get blown up. Good science fiction is, can you walk away from it having learned a lesson about modern day, even though it's set decades in the future? This one deals with the question of what happens when people start relying too much on technology and start losing the ability to interact with one another as human beings.
when the comic book for this was written, the writer has stated that he was looking at people who were addicted to the internet. He's looking at people who can't stay married because they're on the internet so often. People who really can't interact with the real world because they're used to chat rooms.
They can't interact in the real world because they don't have an avatar to hide behind that is completely different than the person they really are.
And so he takes this concept and wraps it up into mechanical beings. He said, you sit at home and you're literally plugged into your computer and your avatar, your surrogate, gets to walk around in your place.
You can look like anybody you want to. You can look like yourself, only 20 years younger. You can change your sex. You can be this big fat slob who couldn't get out of the plug-in chair to save his life, but he's parading around as this hot little blonde in a miniskirt and bra. Which, that is actually a scene from the movie, and when I saw that, I just started laughing and thought to myself, he hit it right on the head, because you hear constantly about these predators who are out there on the internet pretending to be somebody that they're not just to lure people in. So you can look like whoever you want to look like. You can be whoever you want to be. And at the very beginning of the movie, they're talking about all the positives of this. People aren't worried about doing plastic surgery anymore because they can just make their surrogate look like whatever they want to look like. Crime is down because if a surrogate gets shot or run over, the person is still fine at home. They show all these positive aspects of life living through the surrogate. And it reminds me of all the things that people are saying even today about how wonderful it is to be in all these chat rooms and how wonderful it is to be on all these social networks and how there are people out there who have a million friends that they've never laid eyes on personally. And this is actually a subject matter that has been on my mind for years. And the fact that this comic book and this director were able to focus in on it is just wonderful storytelling to me.
It makes its point. And you leave the movie theater, you get the point. And yet it's not in your face.
In fact, the people who would normally be in your face about these types of topics are actually among some of the bad guys within the film. It also does a great job of showing the extremism that people will take on topics. People talk all the time about how there's moral ambiguity and how everything is gray now. There is no black and white. Everything's in the middle. But it's odd because in this day and age, for everything being in the middle, people have very extreme views one way or the other. And if you don't agree with them 100%, things get very extreme. Things like politics and religion are points where people very much become polarized. And if you happen to be in the middle on any type of topic, you get pressure from both sides. No, 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 you can't be in the middle on this. It's either black or white. This movie shows that you're either all in favor of using surrogates, or you're some extreme nut job who doesn't believe in using machinery at all. It just struck me as a very interesting view on how things are going today. Another thing that you hit on was internet addiction. And again, it goes back to that whole idea that people have an easier time interacting through their computer than face-to-face. And the weird thing is that from my own personal experience, it's a whole lot easier to misinterpret what somebody's saying when all you have to rely on is words on a screen. I don't understand why it is that people are finding it so much easier to communicate when they are cutting themselves down to one basic form of communication, when face-to-face communication entails facial gestures, body language, and tone of voice in addition to the words that are actually used.
That's really one of the major points of the movie is once you're inside of a surrogate, you could change your personality. You act like somebody you're not. When you're on a computer and you're anonymous and nobody knows you, you say whatever you want to say because nobody knows who you are. You go away and that's the end of it. Well, when you're a surrogate, you can say or do whatever you want because there's no consequences to you personally.
Yeah, between the loss of communication skills and the apathy that people form, because if there's no consequences to your actions, you don't care whether you've hurt somebody's feelings or not. You don't care if somebody gets the wrong impression of you. I really do believe that this is a trend that we as a society are building on, and it is not the best of situations to be finding ourselves in. we are leaning ourselves towards a society that are losing the ability to deal with each other one-on-one. When you take all of that into consideration, this film has a very, very deep meaning to it.
Email and instant messaging have really killed writing. People don't know how to write anymore.
Between abbreviations and the loss of punctuation and the loss of capitalization, people are just losing the ability to put their thoughts down in a cohesive manner.
The argument on the other side of that is, well, we're coming up with a new form of communication, which is true, but there's a price to pay for that.
I mean, I'm not one of those weirdos who's going to run on out and get rid of my email accounts and delete my websites and cut myself off from technology altogether. My own personal belief is that technology has its place as a tool. And as long as you're able to accept it as a tool and not as your sole means of doing anything, you're okay. But the second that that tool takes over your life, you've got a serious problem. And that's what these characters are dealing with. They've become so attached to their surrogates where they cannot leave the house. They are incapable of leaving their homes and interacting with other people without the use of their surrogates, and it really does cripple them.
And that's exactly what the movie showed. There was no hiding behind that. It was essentially saying that if you're not in your surrogate, you have agoraphobia. At one point, Bruce Willis is walking around in a city, and his FBI partner asks, "How long has it been since you've actually been out of your apartment?" He says, "I can't remember." And she says that they should have given you some sort of sedative to take off the edge.
And her first reaction is, we've got to get you another surrogate very quickly so that you don't have to deal with this. Not a case of you have to learn how to deal with society again, but we've got to get you your crutch again. All of which points directly at addiction. So, as you can probably tell, I loved this film. This was probably the best science fiction film I've seen, honestly, in years. I mean, I loved Star Trek. Star Trek was good for Star Trek, but as far as raw science fiction goes, this movie just blew me away.
Yeah, it really is. Again, classic science fiction. If you look at things that were like done in the 70s, your Omega Man or Soylent Green, it's really done as a modern version of those type of movies.
Or your Star Trek the Original Series.
I liked it only slightly less than Jim, which is not saying anything bad. I just wasn't as passionate.
Of course, this is Willis cast. Bruce Willis did a wonderful job in it. There were shades of John McClane in there. There really wasn't a whole lot of humor to this, but there were a couple of moments where I found myself smiling just because it was Bruce Willis up on the screen again. It's been 20 years since Moonlighting and Die Hard. And he looks all of those 20 years older, but he's still just a phenomenal actor, in my opinion. Rhoda Mitchell played Agent Peters, his FBI partner. Rosamund Pike played his wife. There are so many great things about this movie. To try to hit on them all is, again, going to lead to a 30-hour Willis cast. But the subplot dealing with his wife and the fact that they as a couple have lost their son. He was in an accident. He died. And her way of dealing with this situation is to retreat into her surrogate. He talks about how he hasn't seen her in so long. He's always just dealing with her surrogate. And that relationship leads him to make some of the decisions that he ends up making in the film. And that relationship is such an intricate part of the story. I cannot picture the movie being the same film without that character being there.
Absolutely. Even though it's the B story in the film, it's probably at least as important as the A story.
And Pike is, to me, best known as a Bond girl. And Bond girls kind of have a stigma attached to them that if they weren't famous before becoming a Bond girl, all that they're ever known for is being a Bond girl. And in this film, she really showed me that she's capable of being more than just eye candy. Ving Rhames. The second I saw him on the screen, I was just like, oh yeah.
It's hard to go wrong with Ving Rhames. As easily as we could do a 30-hour Willis cast, we could do a 30-hour Ving cast.
He plays the leader of the militant anti-machinery people, and his part is relatively small in comparison to the rest of the movie. But as I said, the second he came on the screen, I was like, yeah, Ving Rhames is in this film. This is going to be great. He just has an awesome presence about him.
I have to admit, I like the makeup choices that they use for Bing. Now, in modern days, I'm used to seeing him as the bald-headed Kojak look. And to see him with the dreadlocks and the long beard was just so cool.
Yeah, and the choices that they made for him, the second I saw him, I knew that he was the militant nut job.
Ah, but there's still a secret behind that, which I won't spoil.
Yes. Just because I say he's the militant nut job does not make him the bad guy. But I was also able to look and realize how many comparisons that they were drawing to people like Osama bin Laden and some of the more modern-day known terrorists, because he had the big scruffy beard. I mean, he looked like he could be a terrorist. I realize that it's very stereotypical, but they used that stereotype to automatically form an opinion about this character, and it was a great choice. I really can't say anything negative about any of the performers in this. I thought they all did a great job. I mean, James Cromwell was in this thing, and his performance was just fantastic as well. I cannot say a bad thing about these people.
I've always liked James Cromwell, even from when he was in Star Trek.
I almost went to go see Babe because James Cromwell was in it. Almost. So let's wrap this up. Out of 4 pens in the pocket protector,
I give it 3 pens and a definite go see it.
I'm going to give it 3.5 pens and a, if it gets out of the theaters before you get the chance to see it, make sure you rent it on DVD. As you said, I don't think it's going to do that well. It entails far too much thought for your common audience these days.
Yes, and like I said at the beginning, it's getting some negative press. Critics are paid to criticize. They're not paid to be smart.
And they're not paid to think.
As always, thank you for listening to our guest. We would appreciate any of your comments or feedback. Please write jim@twerponline.net.
This has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2009. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Bobo. Ball.